Monday morning, Memorial Day. It's a four-day week. That doesn't mean it's not going to be busy, though. We're joined now for The Agenda by Louise Story, Wall Street and finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Louise, you got a word for the week?
I do. Reassessment.
Reassessment. And Marcus Mabry, editor-at-large of the International Herald Tribune, which is the international edition of our partner, The New York Times. He joins us from BBC Studios in London. Marcus, you have a word?
Commitment.
Commitment. That's interesting.
Those are kind of contradictory words.
They are in a certain way. Well, let me start with you, Marcus, because the big story of last week is, of course, the apprehension of Ratko Mladic. He faces a possible extradition to The Hague this week on charges of genocide. But we also are hearing stories of thousands of Serbians rallying in support of Mladic. And certainly his lawyer has said he's going to appeal the extradition. What's going on with this case?
Well, you know, that's exactly this week's measure for commitment here in Europe is going to be around this story, which is such, you know, you really can't overstate the importance of Ratko Mladic to Europe and kind of Europe's view of its own self in the kind of post-war history and recent history, because he was the guy who is believed to have been responsible for the Srebrenica massacre in July of 1995, and he has been a war criminal suspect since that time. The fact that Serbia finally handed him over In fact, that Serbia finally arrested him was really a measure of their commitment to join the European Union. They were not going to get to do that as long as Ratko Mladic was still at large. That's why they did it. The question this week is, well, is Serbia's commitment to actually handing him over physically to The Hague? And will doctors either in Serbia or doctors in The Hague actually allow Mladic to stand trial? And finally, what's the commitment of the West to the war crimes and genocidal crimes provisions?
And then maybe the Dutch will have to reassess their position on Serbia joining the European Union, right? Speaking of your reassessment, Louise, the unemployment figures are expected out on Friday, and every week we reassess where we stand, where jobs come. What are we expecting this week?
Well, we do, and people are really reassessing whether the economy is actually recovering. And so we're going to get the May figures at the end of this week. Economists are saying that payrolls may have gone up about 185,000, but that would be a drop from April, when they went up 244,000. And so it just seems like the unemployment situation is really stubborn and dug in, and people are really starting to reassess whether the economy is improving.
All right. Let's go back to international news, because we're not going to know what the unemployment figures really. It seems like we always expect something and they're different than what we expected, I guess. That's to be expected. But let's move to Libya, Marcus, because South African President Jacob Zuma arrived in Tripoli today. He is asking for a complete halt to warfare there, the civil war, and that comes after the G8 called for Muammar Gaddafi to step down. He refused to do so, but President Zuma's visit in Tripoli, do you expect anything to come out of that?
It's a great question, Celeste. I can't expect very much out of it because the Libyans at this point, the Libyan regime and Muammar Gaddafi, are so far away from the West at this point. Now, there have been some floaters over the weekend that perhaps the Libyans are willing to consider a ceasefire if Gaddafi gets to stay. Well, of course, at this point, the West has just demonstrated their own commitment, once again, to the fact that they have this established policy that they want Gaddafi to go. It's going to be interesting to see this week because the UN is going to have a debate about its Libya policy. Now, the UN resolution that NATO is there underneath actually says that the commitment is to actually stop innocent Libyan civilians from getting killed. Well, that's not the same as, you know, regime yeah. change in Tripoli. And so that's the fight that we're seeing here is kind of how far does this commitment by the West extend? And if Gaddafi is willing to say we'll actually have a ceasefire, if he were to do something really dramatic and come out with Zuma and say that we are willing to do a ceasefire, then how, on what grounds do Washington, London, and Paris continue this fight? Especially since Washington already has a very different view from its European allies. Now, after the G8, they papered over the differences very well. It seemed like everyone spoke with one voice. But the fact is, Paris and London would like for Washington to do a lot more than the Americans so far have been willing to do as far as even an air campaign. And so we'll see, you know, how long these allies can actually stay unified. It's not clear.
I don't think we're going to see any American helicopters there anytime soon. Let's come back to the United States, though. AT&T's buyout of T-Mobile is coming under a great deal of close scrutiny. Obviously, the deal still has yet to be approved by the Department of Justice and the FCC. So, Louise, what is the debate weighing out to be? What are the pros and cons here?
So in Washington, policymakers have really been arguing back and forth over this, holding hearings. And the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, just asked for a lot of information from AT&T. AT&T says they need T-Mobile. They need T-Mobile in order to provide universal service across America, that they need that spectrum.
Right.
But the FCC is really questioning that, saying, well, show us other deals you have with other carriers to patch over those areas. And there's a lot of questions being raised about whether this deal will simply raise prices for consumers and quash competition in the cell phone space.
I imagine Sprint isn't too happy about it either. But in our last minute here, I wanted to talk about of the last of the government stake in Chrysler. And Fiat is really interested in purchasing this out. But the U.S. government is still going to lose billions, right?
The U.S. government is still owed $2 billion on Chrysler. And even with this Fiat buying the last stake, they're unlikely to get it back. So it makes us reassess whether these bailouts were profitable or not.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't think you can evaluate it the same way you can evaluate a bank bailout, because
that's true. The car bailouts, there have been a lot of jobs created.
Thousands.
And it's interesting, you can't do just profit. It's like you did on the Wall Street bailouts, but then turn that around and say maybe some of the Wall Street bailouts should be evaluated like the car bailouts. You know, what was the good to society? Because we are thinking of the car bailouts more in these job figures and good to society.
All right. Louise Story reassessing all the time. She's a Wall Street and finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. And Marcus Mabry is committed to the International Herald Tribune, where he's editor at large. That's the international edition of the New York Times. Thanks, Marcus. Thanks, Louise.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.